This is the continuation of session 7.
Next one says, live in three ways that never get weaker. Live in three ways that never get weaker. Okay. The three ways are three kinds of behavior for Lojong. Okay, someone practicing Lojong. The first one is called Lama Lam Murgu. Lama Lam Murgu means never lose your devotion and your faith in your Lama. Okay, be very, very, very picky on who you choose as your Lama. Like, don't do it easily. Tradition in the old days was wait 12 years. Check them out for 12 years, you know. And then go to them and say, okay, I'd like to take you as my Lama. There's a joke. There was a great Mongolian prince who came to a Tibetan Lama and said, I've checked you out for 12 years, and guess what? And Lama said, what? You know, and he said, I've decided you're okay, and I'm going to become your student. You know, and then the Lama said, well, now I'll check you out for 12 years before I agree. And then the Lama says, don't wait too long, okay? Like, 12 years is maybe extreme, you know? I mean, but check out this person very thoroughly, okay? Be like a private investigator. You know, talk to their students. Talk to the people who used to be their students that don't like them anymore. Talk to, you know, people who they've taught. Talk to people who are sponsoring them. Talk to people that know them, where they live, or, you know, and investigate them and find out if this is the right teacher for you. There are thousands of different kinds of personalities, and there are thousands of different wonderful, beautiful, holy teachers in the world, and you just have to find the one that fits your personality. And it won't always be that every teacher is the right one for you. You have to find the one that you really connect with. And don't be embarrassed to ask questions, and don't be shy about it. It's your life at stake, and, you know, make sure that this person is the one that fits you. After you've decided, then go for it. You know, don't. This one means don't lose your devotion after that, okay? Once you've made the commitment, normally the next day you'll find out some terrible thing that, okay, this is normal. This is like after getting married, you know, like the day after. And something will always come up. After that, you have to be steadfast. Second thing is Lojong La Dro. Lojong La Dro means love this Lojong, okay? I mean, get to, let it become your friend. And develop a love for it where you enjoy it. Be happy doing it. Don't see it as an obligation. Okay. In the monastery at Sarah, if you get caught going to Kushalnagar and watching a movie in one of those little video huts, which I've never seen, they call your name during an assembly, and you have to come up to the front, and they give you this huge movie poster. And you have to hold it up like that for like an hour, you know? And everyone's making fun of you and laughing at you. And then they make you do like 1,000 prostrations or something to the monks, you know? And then I remember the disciplinarian got up one day and said, actually, this is not fair. You know, and everybody's like, oh, come on, it doesn't hurt anybody to hold up that poster, you know? And he's, no, it's the prostration thing. It's not fair, you know? And they said, why? And he said, that's the most fun I can imagine, is doing 1,000 prostrations to all the monks of Sarah May. You know, that's no punishment. This is an honor. This is a good time. This is a thrill. I'd love to do it myself, but I don't want to go to the movies, you know. And he was very sincere, you know. He was like, this is not a punishment. This is an honor, you know. And anyway, that's what Lojong La Dro means, okay? Third one. Chen Shen Ki Labja Sungwa means keep a high degree of mindfulness about keeping your vows and keeping your pledges. And the book, there's nothing like the book, okay? You can say, I know my vows, which nobody does. You can say, I keep them pretty well, which means you don't even check. And then, you know, people who keep Tun Tuk, six-session yoga, which means checking your vows every 2 hours, every 2.5 hours, then that's real mindfulness. If you get to where you check your vows every 2 hours or 2.5 hours, and I don't mean all of them. For a fully ordained monk with tantric and bodhisattva vows, it's 484 vows if you don't count these Lojong commitments, okay? It means just check, make a rotation, you know, check one or two every 2 hours, every 2.5 hours. That is mindfulness. That's the third training here. There's no other way to do it. You know, you meet nice people who are in Dharma centers, and you say, are you keeping your vows? And they say, pretty good. And you say, be honest, do you even know your vowels? And they'll say, you know, I can't remember all of them, but I know most of the main ones. And you say, well, just how do you check your vowels? And they say, well, I don't have any formal system. I just generally try to be a good person. I try to do what Lama Sopa tells me, you know. And that's not enough. It won't get you into a tantric paradise. It doesn't work that way. That's why in every Uttara Tantra initiation, Anuttara Yoga initiation in the Tantras, the highest tantric initiations you can take, they all require that every 2 hours you stop and check your vowels. It's called Tundug Lame Nelzor, six-session yoga. You know what I mean? Every 2 or 2.5 hours you stop, you check one of your vowels, and you check how's your mind doing right now. How are you doing on this vowel? And that's the only way you're going to change this into Manjushri's arm. There's no other way. There is no other way. That's why the highest tantras require that. All the highest Anuttara yoga initiations require that you do six-session yoga. So it got corrupted in Tibet. Some lama wrote a thing called, you know, you can do six sessions twice a day, which is in itself a contradiction. It's like jumbo shrimp or military intelligence. You can do a two-session, six-session yoga. You see what I mean? And it became a custom to speed through it in the morning for 10 minutes and speed through it in the evening for 10 minutes. And they wrote out a little recitation that you could do. And then you're just wandering. I used to do it on the bus from work, and I'd just be staring out the window. And like a week later, I'd say, I did it 7 times this week, and I don't remember doing it once. You know what I mean? I kept my vow, meaning I recited it, but I didn't think about it at all. And frankly, not much changed in my life until I started keeping a book and tracking it carefully. You know, that was like 7 years ago or something. It's a very good thing. You should do it. You have to do it, okay? This thing about vaguely knowing your vows and vaguely trying to be a nice guy, that's not the same thing. You know, you have to check them every 2 hours or so. That's how that system works, and that's how your karma gets good enough to change into a tantric dhyani. Because your arm is
empty.
Okay, good. Take a break. If you want, come up and see this stuff, and they'll hand out some stuff too. Okay. Okay, next line says, keep the three that should never be lost. That's easy. That's virtues in your speech, what you say, virtues in what you do, and virtues in what you think. Okay, that's easy. Now on to the next section. It says, act towards each one free of bias. Spread your love and make it deep. Constantly think of the special ones. Okay, this is mainly referring to the fact that once you've signed up for Lojong practice, you have to try very hard not to be biased towards other people. So try to behave the same towards your people who try to hurt you and towards people who are nice to you. In the text it says, don't try to be kind to people who are Dharma practitioners and then be unkind to people who are crazy and bad to you and things like that. Then you don't understand Lojong if that's how you're acting. The special ones mentioned here, he says, that could be your mother, your father, your family, your lama, the person who gave you your vows, but most especially the people you don't like. Okay. In other words, people who try to hurt you. Okay. Don't let it depend on circumstances means, that's a thing about the Varanasi train station. If things are going well, people tend, I think it was Nietzsche said, anyone who's just had a good meal, sees the world as all nice people or something. Most people's perception of the world depends on what kind of lunch they had. And you can't be like that. If you're studying Lojong, even when you have a headache, even when your back hurts, even when you just had a fight with somebody, even when you just got refused some position you were hoping for, even if you just lost a lot of money, you have to be acting the same towards everybody. You have to be free of circumstances around you, especially when you're not feeling well. Okay, I had this one Dharma student I didn't like, and they used to give me a hard time. And then later I found out that they had this terrible backaches all the time. And when they got over that, they were very sweet. You see what I mean? And, you know, don't be like that. Don't be nasty when you have a backache. And also, conversely, try to be sweet to people who are irritable because maybe they just have a backache, or maybe this morning they had an argument with their wife or something, and try to understand that other people probably act the same way that you do, which is that normally when people are being mean or grumpy, it's because something went wrong today already, and you're just seeing them afterwards. Okay, so be sensitive to that and try not to be like that. Okay. Now we're on the last verse. It's got about 8 lines. These are short but sweet. It's I'm going to read the Tibetan just for purposes of lung thing. Yula chokme da du chö kyap tang ting jong kun la che kuwa nam la da du gong kenshin dag la du mi cha tare zo nyam se lang kolok mi cha. These are the advices start. You can hear them starting, right? It's like poetry. Listen to poetry. Yula chokme da du chö kyap tang ting jong kun la che kuwa nam la da du gong kenshin dag la du mi cha tare zo nyam se lang. Then he says kolok mi cha ren jong mi cha to chut chang ta chen ni star ja yim gom golom madom ni cham ja o che da. Don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. Sounds like it's holiness. Okay, act now, do the most important thing. Okay, that's the first one. Act now means now that you have a lama, you have a human being teaching you, you have the dharma, you're alive, you're healthy, you have a brain, you got fed enough today, you're at Goa, couldn't be nicer. So get moving. Do the most important thing. Most important thing, try to stop your tendency to take care of yourself first. Okay? Try to replace it with this constant attitude of how can I help other people. I see Bodhisattva Dharma students sitting on a bed, typing away at their computer. Somebody comes in the door, their arms are filled with things, they can hardly open the door, they're stumbling along the floor, things are falling off the tray, and they're just staring at them, you know, like, that's interesting. You know, and it's just a basic failure to put yourself in another person's shoes, you know. Oftentimes the most basic test of whether you're doing Bodhisattva work is what is your ability to stand up and move forward. You know, when someone needs something, and put your hands out. It's not very glorious or sexy or anything. It's just how fast can you get out of a chair to help somebody? And it seems to me a direct correlation between people who are seem to me to be trying to act out the Bodhisattva ideal, and people are able quickly to get up out of a chair and move ahead and help somebody. You know what I mean? There seems to be a direct correlation to me. I don't know. Let's see. Okay, second one. Don't get it backwards, okay? Don't get it backwards. There are 6 backwardses. They're on your homework. Okay. Here are the 6 backwards kinds of behavior. First one, when it comes time to your job, your worldly stuff, you can undergo any kind of hardship. And I can tell you that. You know, I used to get up at 5:30, 5 o'clock, eat quickly, stand out, snow, rain, heat, wait for the New Jersey Transit bus, you know, getting soaked, or, you know, out there for 30 minutes, you know, whatever it took, you know, then this ride to what they call Cancer Alley, which is an hour and a half through the refineries of northern New Jersey, you know, choking on this pollution, and then you get delivered at the Port Authority, which is the scummiest place in the world, until I saw, well, anyway, and then you go downstairs and get into the subway, which is the worst place in New York. And then another half-hour ride trying to beat off, you know, drunks and, you know, trying not to smell the things. And then get up, have to walk another half-hour through the snow or the rain or whatever. And then just, you know, after 2 hours of that, you're totally exhausted. You fall into the door of this company, and it's time to begin work. You know what I mean? And you do it. You know, I did it for 15 years. You know, people do it. People do it happily. They don't even think about it. I mean, not happily, but they do it. They don't think it's strange in New York City to get up at 5, come home at 8, eat, watch the news, go to bed, and go and do it again tomorrow. And that's... people are willing to do that. Then you say, okay, now we're in Goa. Can you get up at 5 o'clock and meditate for an hour? Then study for 8 hours? And then... we'll even let you have a half hour on the beach. And then you're like, are you kidding me? You know, I'm in Goa. I'm at a Dharma teaching. You know, I'm going to get up at 9. I'll have some hot chocolate. You know, I'll get out to the beach. I'll look over that Lojong thing from yesterday, just finish the homework as fast as I can, and then maybe catch the second teaching. You know, something like that. I mean, your whole... the whole Western thing about work. Work is sacred, you know. I got in trouble if I was 10 minutes late. You know, it's a 2-hour commute. I got in trouble if I was 10 minutes late. Then they would keep me 3 hours late. And I couldn't understand it. I used to go to the bus. I said, how come if I'm 10 minutes late, I get in trouble, but you can make me stay 3 hours late? And he's like, he says, this is not Citibank. You know, meaning this is a real company, you know. And like that. So you're willing to undertake these kinds of hardships day after day, year after year, for something that you can't keep. You know, whatever salary I made, I only had an afternoon to spend it. That was Saturday afternoon. You know, Sunday I had to wash the clothes and be nervous about Monday. And that's it. You know that's how it is. So if you're willing to do that, the first backwards is willing to do it for your job, but not willing to do it for the Dharma. You know, and I was worried when I quit the company because I thought I would get soft, you know, because Dharma doesn't push you. You see, I mean, you meditate or you don't meditate, nobody's yelling at you. You don't cut your paycheck. It doesn't show up anywhere, you know what I mean? And I think you have to learn to be disciplined yourself, okay? Second one, enjoy the flavor of worldly things and not the flavor of the Dharma, you know? If you really understand Lojong or emptiness or something like that, and then to sit down and read a text about it, it should become eventually as pleasant as going to a good movie or something like that, okay? And you should reach a point where you can't put it down, you know? Like, you just can't stop. People say, you know, could you just take a break and go swimming? And you're like, no, I can't, because I don't want to. This is more fun, you know what I mean? And should reach a point where they're about the same for you. Okay, third one. You feel sympathy for those who are working hard on Dharma, but not for those who are doing bad deeds. Meaning, okay, it's very easy to be a good person around good people. My Lama, I mean, we were at Sera, and I was at this Mongolian monastery for 8 years. And, you know, just meditating, studying, perfect circumstances, you know, a perfect temple, no other problems, the greatest Lama in the world. And just sit there all day long and give teachings and meditate and things like that. And then he said, now you have to go to work. And I said, Rinpoche, I don't have to go to work. My mom passed away. I still have some money. He says, no, it's time to go to work, you know. And I said, I don't want to go to work. And he said, no, you have to go to work in New York. Go work in an office in New York. And I'm like, no. And he kept this up for like 6 months, you know. And then one day I remember he went to Rutgers and gave a beautiful talk. And on the way home, I said, I'll do anything you want, you know. He said, go to work. And so I went to work, you know. And it wasn't pleasant. And it wasn't, it's easy to be happy when all the people around you are trying to do Dharma. Sometimes I think to be a Lama is a very dangerous thing because you only meet devoted people who are crazy enough to study all day and try to practice Dharma, and you don't really get to meet normal people, and who are can be very rough. I mean, in business in New York, you know, half the people you meet during the day might be very, very rough people, and I think you need to do that. I think it's very healthy. So, I mean, my Lama used to encourage people to have a real side job that they did in addition to their Dharma, not just for the money. Because I didn't need the money, but it was to learn how normal people think, which I think helps your teaching and your translation. If you're going to be a translator, have a normal job, see how normal people talk. It's not at all what they say they talk about in Dharma centers. Okay, no, and learn to say things in a normal way to normal people. This is very useful. Okay, number four. Try to succeed in your Dharma work rather than your worldly work. Meaning, try to be a Dharma success and not a worldly success. We talked about yesterday what it means to be a Dharma success is only one thing in the Lojong. Are you happier than you were 6 months ago? Okay? Do you have fewer mental afflictions than you had 6 months ago? Is your tendency to take care of yourself first less than it used to be 6 months ago? It has nothing to do with learning a tantric sadhana by memory. It has nothing to do with Tibetan grammar. It has nothing to do with how many Tibetan words you know. It has nothing to do with whether you can ring your bell at the right time or not. It has nothing to do with being the administrator of a project or doing some project for your lama or something like that. It's with how have you changed your mind? You see, I mean, are you happier 6 months later than you were 6 months before? And then we can say you're a Dharma success. Okay, and if you've memorized all this Tibetan and you know everything up and down and you're in charge of biggest project number 53 and, you know, you have red robes on and you know, you ring your bell at the right time, but if you're still a schmuck, you know, then who cares? You see what I mean? Then what is it? What's the Dharma? You know, what's the point? You know what I mean? And I'm speaking as a person who's gotten caught up in all those other things. You know what I mean? And you mistake all those other activities for progress, which is progress means, are you happier than you were 6 months ago? And are you a nicer person? And do you think of other people more than you used to? That's all. So don't give that up for worldly success. And there's a lot of worldly success to be found in the Dharma. You know, it becomes a business for people. You know, how many verbs do you know? You know, I understand you're trying to practice Tantra, but are you well aware that you ring your bell with the wrong hand? You know, or, you know what I mean? Or stuff like that. You know what I mean? No, it becomes a thing like that. Be careful, okay? All right. You have to ring the bell with the right hand, but that's a different thing. Okay. Which is your left hand. But anyway, I think. You teach those who... Okay, somebody comes to you for Dharma help, and instead you give them worldly stuff to do and worldly advice. Okay, and this is a tendency. Okay, Lama Sopa is a very good example. You know, you can go to Lama Sopa and ask him about your car business. You can go to Lama Sopa and ask him about a translation. You know, you can go to Lama Sopa and ask him about the administration of your Dharma center, and he just twists it around and asks you how you're doing personally. You know, immediately he's onto some deep Dharma thing. He refuses to talk about shallow things. You know, everything to him is deep. Everything to him is... Like, he can't even eat a hot dog in New York without 2 hours of prayers about it. You know what I mean? We've seen this. It wasn't a hot dog. It was some vegetarian thing. Anyway, at 3 a.m. And, you know, everything to him is a sacred thing. So he refuses to turn the sacred into the worldly. And I think we tend to do the opposite. You know, everything... People come to you for... advice, people come to you. You have an opportunity, an honest opportunity. I'm not saying that you're selling the Dharma to people or you're pushing people, but someone comes to you sincerely and they ask you a sincere question about Dharma. It's a perfect opportunity to talk about emptiness or karma or tantric deities, and you start talking about some movie or something. You see what I mean? And that's the next kind of backwards. What number are we on? 4, right? That was 5, yeah. Number 6 is backwards means rejoicing in other people's problems and their failures instead of rejoicing in their virtues and what they do right. Okay. We did an interesting thing in Ireland, you know. We started translating the 10 non-virtues in a positive way. Okay? So instead of saying don't kill, don't steal, don't do sexual misconduct, it was respect life, respect other people's property, and strive for sexual purity. You know what I mean? And we switched the whole thing around. And it got to be a very interesting feeling, you know? The whole feeling was different. And it was great. It's like, respect life gives you a different... If you get up in the morning and say, I'm going to respect life today, rather than I'm not going to kill anything, it seems more powerful to me, you know? Anyway, when we got to number 8 and number 9, the two of the 3 mental deeds, you know, we just had this insight into it. People call it craving and ill will, you know what I mean? But I think to say that the craving part is to be unhappy when someone else gets something nice, okay? The 8th non-virtue of the 10 is to be unhappy when something else happens good for somebody else. And then number 9 is the opposite, which is what? Taking some kind of pleasure out of other people's problems. And you have to watch out for those things. I went on an 8 and 9 binge like the last few months. It was like in the winter in New York, and you know, I realized I have 8 and 9, and I went on a binge and did them for like 2 months every day. It was really good, and you should try it. Try it sometime. I mean, not doing them, right? Okay. Okay. What's the next thing? says, don't be on and off. Dharma practice is like jogging or dancing or yoga or any other kind of exercise, or it has to be daily. It has to be at the same time every day. It has to be a modest, reasonable practice that challenges you. And if you don't do that, you won't get anywhere. So it's better to spend 20 minutes a day regularly than it is to go on a big Dharma, you know, push for 3 weeks and then you just stop for 6 months. You see what I mean? So build up something modest. I think we mentioned the other night, don't make your practice too complicated. Don't do 46 different things. I have people come to me all the time and say, I do Vajrasattva, then I do Maharaja, then I do, you know, Yamantaka, and then I do 14 Atara, and then I do 16 this, and 18 that, and 48 of that, and I run through these three sadhanas, and I say, do you really think about those things while you're saying them? And they say, no, never. I'm just trying to get to the next one. You know what I mean? And make it simple. I don't mean make it stupid. Make it sweet. Make it leisurely. Make it profound. Make it very sacred. You know, and the trick is to do it at the same time every day, okay? And just let people know that you're not available at those times, okay? And I think in New York we've gotten pretty good at it recently, okay? We have a Dharma policeman who enforces it, and, you know, we get all these invitations. People say, do you want to meet the Dalai Lama at 12:30? I say, no, I'm not done with my practice till 1. You see what I mean? You just make a rule, and you don't break it. And then people stop calling you before 1 because they know you're not going to answer the phone. Okay? Like that. Make a time. Same time every day. More powerful. Next one. Make up your mind and stick to it. The commentary says at this point, decide what level of Dharma practice you're capable of doing and then stick to it. Okay? Dupma dupa chene deranga shak means decide where your level is at and then stick to it and go for it. And you have to be, this is that thing about challenging yourself. If you've done sports before, you're always supposed to, I used to row. We had to do 1 year of sports in my college and it was, you know, I hated it. And I decided that the closest thing to swimming or surfing would be, in New Jersey, would be rowing. And it was a skull thing with 8 guys in these long oars and, you know, and every day we went out for practice, and they would make us do a little bit more than the day before. You know, it was always 5 minutes more than the day before, or, you know, 5 pounds more, or 1 lap more. And it was very, that's what this one is talking about. You know, set yourself a practice which challenges you, and then keep pushing the envelope a little bit each day. You know, don't be satisfied, especially with the priority of your practice, okay? A lot of people say, I'm set, you know, and you say, what do you mean set? And you say, I live in a Dharma center, I recite Yamantaka for 2.5 hours every morning, and I ring the bell at the right time, and that's it, you know? And I became a monk or a nun, and I'm satisfied, you know? And then you say, well, you know, did you do Kirim, you know? And they say, no, I'm not doing Kirim, I'm just reciting the thing. And they say, well, did you do Dzogchen? And they say, that's for people who are better than me. I can't do that, you know. I can't go to highest tantra practices. I like this sadhana thing because I finally learned how to ring the bell and where to ring the bell, you know. And they, like, get stuck. They get attached to it. You see, I finally memorized the Vajrayogini sadhana. I finally figured out where Rinpoche wants me to ring the bell, you know. So I'm set. That's it. I don't need anything else. I don't want to go further than that. You see, I mean, but you have to keep pushing the envelope until you get up to the most powerful practices you can. That's your responsibility. Once you took Bodhisattva vows, which you did, from His Holiness, right? Once you've taken a tantric initiation, you can't just cruise, okay? You have to keep reaching for the next thing, and you have to try to get enlightened faster, okay? You can't be satisfied and just comfortable with what you've learned and just stop there, okay? I'll tell you a true story. Geshe Kalden, he's a Mongolian, Inner Mongolian. He taught me some Abhidharma. And he was getting old, and he was dying. And I helped him fix his room before that. I helped him put up some new walls and stuff. And then he lived in this very tiny, simple room. And I used to go there and he would teach me, and then one night, you know, he's obviously going to die in a week or something. He was wheezing, he's like flat on his back. He didn't have the power to put his robes down, and I felt really embarrassed for him. You know what I mean? How you see somebody naked who is like your teacher or something, and you're like, and it does something to your heart, you know, and I like pull his robes down and say, you know, Geshe-la, you know, what's going to happen? And he's reading this book, you know, and I figure it's probably a power practice or something, you know. And he puts the book down and he says, here, you can have this book. I probably won't need it, but let me keep it for a week until I die, you know. And I'm like, what's the book, Geshe-la? And he says, it's elementary logic. You know, and I'm like, this is what they teach kids 15 years old in the monastery, Dura. I said, Geshe-la, you're passing, you know. What are you reading elementary logic for? He says, I'm getting ready for my next line. he's like, this is profound stuff. You know, he says, you don't stop. You know, your mind doesn't stop. I'm trying to load everything in before I die. You know, and he's very adamant about it. He's like, I want to review everything before I die. You know, and he's like pushing. You see, he's pushing. Even up to the moment of death, he's pushing his mind. You know, he's like pushing his body. See if his body. He can't lift his robes. He can't get his robes down, but he can hold up this book and he's reading. He doesn't want to die without it in his mind. You see, and it's very cool. So you got to push like that. You got to be willing to undertake some pain sometimes. Okay, that's one of the kinds of the fourth perfection, is to be willing to put up with some pain when you're doing Dharma. Okay, no pain, no gain. A lot of people, because Dharma work is not like your worldly work, you know, I knew lots of people at work. In my job, we didn't have health insurance, and if you missed a day, you didn't get paid for it. So people would be throwing up in the corner, people would have migraine headaches, people would come to work with horrible colds. And, you know, you can do it if you have a family and you need the money, and, you know, they just come. You just go. You don't think about it. You go, you know. And then when you do your Dharma, you're so wimpy, you know. Like, I don't feel like meditating today. Why? It's too hot. You know, next day, I don't feel like meditating today. Why? It's too cold. You know, and then it's just like that. You're just wimpy when you're Dharma stuck. Because there's nobody checking. You still get your paycheck. Okay, stuff like that. Next one. Figure out both and free yourself. We're just about finished. Figure out both is very interesting. It means figure out how it is that your last big mental affliction incident occurred. You know, do some research. You know, like, I got angry yesterday at one of my students. So go back and try to recreate the situation. You know, what was it that made me angry? Why did I get angry? What was it happening 3 minutes before that? What was happening 2 minutes before that? What was it that pushed me over the edge and got me angry? You know, what was it that I said something? You know, what? Go back and study your old failures, okay? And then the second part of that, it says figure out both, right? Figure out how you're going to deal with it next time, okay? In advance, proactively, figure out how you can prevent the same series of mistakes from happening, okay? And that's a Lojong practice, you know? Analyze your past emotional failures, and then plan for the next one. And free yourself. Next one says, stop thinking about how wonderful you are. Okay. There's times when you're supposed to meditate on how wonderful you are. Okay. This refers to, like, you finally got off your butt and you're doing some kind of service of other people. Like, you finally are volunteering to help at the Dharma Center, or you're finally working at the Three Jewels to help people there, or you're finally doing something, okay? Then you get this feeling like, I'm the greatest, you know? I'm really a major bodhisattva, you know? And the author, Geshe Chikawa, he says, there's two reasons why you shouldn't think like that, okay? There's two reasons why you shouldn't get some kind of big pride about being a major bodhisattva just because you've just started to help other people. First one, they need it really bad. Okay? I mean, we recently, I don't know, we were in Ireland, right? And we were following a car right after we got off the flight. And I'm watching this car, I'm driving behind this car, and the car veers over to the side, the wrong side, which in Ireland is the wrong side. And then it hits a wall, you know? And we're like freaking out, and we all stop, we all jump out, and we all run over there. And there's an old nun in the front seat, and her sister's in the other side, and they're on their way to the hospital, and she falls asleep, and you know, it's like a really trouble. So everyone's there, and everyone's like trying to get the door open, and trying to get them out, and trying to help them, and then at that moment, you see, you're not going to stand there and suddenly stop and say, you know, I'm a really great person, you know, I can't believe I'm out here doing this, you know, for an old nun. You know, we're really good Buddhists, you know, and I hope they find out that we're Buddhists, you know, or something like that. And you stand there and praising yourself or congratulating yourself. It's inappropriate when the other party is suffering badly. And that's always the case in samsara. The people who don't understand about karma are in the process of killing themselves. And you shouldn't have time. I mean, your mind should be more on how can you help them than on how great you are. Okay, that's the first thing to think. Second thing is, when you took bodhisattva vows, there's a line in there that says, "Naran kinagi tendaku." Tendaku means, I hereby decide that I am the slave of the entire world. You know, I hereby offer my body into the service of everyone in the world who needs it. You know, I am now the slave of everyone in the world. Like, you know, just tell me what you need and I'll do it for you. You know what I mean? And having said that, when you took your bodhisattva vows, that's why they do them in Tibetan, so you don't know what you're saying. Having said that, now it's too late to be proud about it. You're an employee. You know, the world owns you. And, you know, you can't get proud about it. That's your responsibility. You made that commitment already. So why are you getting proud about it? It's like proud about being the waiter, you know. You already agreed to be the waiter. So you can't, like, go up to the people eating the food and say, aren't I great, you know? I'm feeding you. I'm delivering your food, you know. I'm such a good waiter. You know, I said, no, that's your job. Okay, all right. Next one says, don't let little things get to you, and it means when you get into the Dharma business, 30% of the people will love you and send you these nice notes and flowers. Right, Bapple? 30% will say you're a really bad person. Bapple didn't want to be translator on Mongolian TV because he said 500,000 Mongolians the next day are going to expect me to be a saint. You know what I mean? And they did, and he's, anyway, I think he is. But anyway, you can trust in advance that due to your own karma, you know, 30% of the people will love you, 30% will think you're bad or crazy, and 30% won't care about you at all. And if you go to another country, after 2 weeks, it'll be the same percentage. Master Shantideva said, if you go into a room with 10 people, you will be attracted to 3 of them, you will find 3 of them disgusting, and then you won't care about the other 4. And then if you take the 3 people that you like and you put them in another room with 6 other people you like, then after a week, you will hate 3 of them, like 3 of them, and feel neutral about 4 of them. You see, I mean, it's not a function of those people, it's your mind. It's your own mind. Anywhere you go in the world, due to your own karma, a certain percentage of people are going to criticize you. And you should just be, when you get in the Dharma business, just get used to it, especially running a center, right, Namgyala? You know, 1/3 of the people will start to criticize. You're teaching Dharma for free. You spend 20 years of your life training yourself. You paid for all the materials. You're paying for the rent. You know, you're doing all this stuff for free. You go to work for 16 hours so that you can teach for an hour or two afterwards. And people will still complain. I don't like this Xerox. You know, the Xerox is crooked. You know, or you know, I don't like the refreshments that Pelma makes for us. You know, I can't believe you don't have tea without milk in it. You know what I mean? Or I can't believe you're robbing me blind. You know, what's robbing you blind? Oh, there's a donation box in the back. You know, and you know, stuff like that. And you'll get accused of every strange thing. The point is, don't be discouraged, okay? This happens in every Dharma center in the world. There's always 2 or 3 people who think that this whole thing is terrible and the teacher is terrible and everything like that. And probably they're perceiving it that way, okay? And And just chill out. Just help the people you can help. Don't worry. You know, smile to the other people. I'm sorry you're not happy. I'm doing the best I can with no money, no help, no place to teach you, and nobody to pay for anything. But you know, I'm just doing the best I can. And if it's not good enough, then I'm sorry. You know, I hope you're happy. You know, and like that. Be happy. That's all you can do. There will always be situations like that. Okay, next. Don't change from moment to moment. That just means don't get on this thing of happy, sad, happy, sad, happy, sad. Okay? You can't control your past karma very well. It's like a wild bull. And you can do the four forces and you can follow Dharma. It's not going to have a major change in your world immediately. It takes time. So be patient with it. And things will continue to go up and down. Good things will happen, bad things will happen. On the whole, everything will go up. You know what I mean? On the whole, your life will become amazing. But deal with the troughs. You know, deal with the ups and downs. And don't be much happier or much sadder than you were. Okay? I mean, in the sense of being upset. And don't get too excited about things either. You know what I mean? The person who wrote you that last note and told you what a great lama you are might very well write you in 3 weeks and tell you what a bad lama you are. And just, you know, it's okay. You know, just take it and do the best you can and help people the best you can. Okay. Last one. Don't expect anything. That's pretty self-explanatory. The commentary gives three kinds of thanks that you shouldn't expect. Okay. Thanks number one. Don't expect any help from these Bodhisattva Dharma students. Okay. I got this letter. I sent a guy in New York. I sent him to Sarah Monastery to study. I got a letter back the first night. It's this 12-page letter from this guy telling me how horrible the monks treat the young monks, you know. Which means they hit them once in a while with a rosary, okay? It's called dots on your head. You know, you come home from the debate ground and you got this... You can't hide it. You know, you're like... You're like, how you doing? You say, you got dots, didn't you? And you're like, yeah. And, you know, that's discipline in the monastery, you know. You goof up, they whack you, you know, and you got this dots. It doesn't hurt so bad. I mean, it's just embarrassing mostly. So I get this letter, you know. The people here are really cruel, and I don't like this place, and like that, you know. And why did I bring that up? Anyway... It was like, anyway, if you're in, I forgot, I'll try to tie it together later. Yeah, well, just in general, the first one is that don't expect help from people, okay? Don't expect help cleaning up Namgyala after the course. Don't expect them to donate the money that is obviously needed to run the place. Don't expect much from other people, okay? And don't get mad about it. Oh, now I remember. Now I remember. So the guy wrote me this letter, and I wrote him back, and he said, these monks are weird because they actually beat the kids up, you know? And I said, they're not beating them up. They're disciplining. That's why Jampa is so nice, because he got 20 years of it. And don't think that... What's I said? I lost it again. Anyway.
You don't go to monastery.
Oh, yeah. The reason you go to a monastery is to fix yourself. You see what I mean? Don't be surprised at Sarah May if you see somebody yelling at some kid or two monks arguing or don't freak out, you know, that they're not all going around like, oh, money, baby, you know. The reason people like me take ordination is that we need to fix ourselves, you know. So don't expect monks and nuns to be like saints. We became a monk or nun so that we could become a saint later by being a monk or nun. And the reason we became a monk or nun is that we're not saints. And you see what I mean? So, you know, the reason people join a Dharma center is because they're trying to fix their mind. And by definition, in the first few years, they don't have a fixed mind. So they're not going to help you. You know, it's the older students or the more mature students who understand that this thing is important and beneficial and sweet, that they should take responsibility to run things and not feel bitter when people don't help you, okay? If they're not helping you, it means they should be in the Dharma Center. You get it? You know? If they're incapable of the least movement to help you with anything, It means they belong here. Okay? You get it? Okay, all right. Okay. Yeah.
What's your natural cutoff point for
I think it's like 76 kalpas or something. Okay. The point at which you can kick them out of the Dharma Center when they don't help.
Your give up point, maybe.
There's no give up point. You can't give up. Okay. Unfortunately. Okay. Second one is praise, okay? Don't expect any praise. It's the nature of things, you know. Rinpoche taught us for 25 years. I remember distinctly him in the bathroom after Sechu cleaning up the toilet and then going out to sweep the floor because people eat the offerings. They trash the place in a way that you would never do in your own home, and then they go home. And we would often stay up for 2 or 3 hours after the students left for this high tantric ritual, cleaning up after all these bodhisattvas who just didn't occur to them that somebody had to clean it up, you know what I mean? And and no one thanks and no one prays. Don't expect people to praise you. Most likely the only people who communicate to you will be the people who criticize you, and just be happy. Say, okay, I have my failures, I have my faults, I'm just trying to make this place go, and you know, if it's good for you, come. If it's not, it's okay. I'm sorry. You know, try to make them happy. Okay, last one. Fame. You know, don't try to get any fame. Fame is very dangerous. You know, as I get more well known, good or bad, okay, in the world, more and more people opening doors for me, more and more people sending a car for me, more and more people overfeeding me, and it actually gets to be, I think, very dangerous. It gets to be a big obstacle. You know what I mean? Like, then you're like expecting people to do that, and you get upset when people don't do that. And I think it's, and then what's strange is I miss working, because at work people used to scream at me. You know, if you don't perform in a corporation in America, they go after you. And if you don't perform long enough, they get rid of you. And there's no mercy. It's not like some countries that have social welfare systems. It's very, I kind of like the purity of it. I like the honesty of it. You either perform or you're gone. And there's no like, oh, sorry, you know. It's nothing like that. And I think in the Dharma, it's the same way. You know what I mean? I miss having healthy, you know, honest people around who can criticize you honestly and say, you know, maybe you should do this or that, you know. And that's very helpful, actually. So what I'm saying is that fame is actually a very dangerous thing, and it's not a very desirable thing. And you have to be careful not to expect it. And I think if you ever get it, you'll find it's quite uncomfortable, actually. You know, I'll give you an example. I'm not criticizing anybody. Okay? We were in Indiana. It was the last day of His Holiness's teaching, and this huge limousine pulls up. And we're all sitting on the ground in the parking lot eating off the ground, you know, like pizza or something. And we're joking to this limo driver. We say, I'm here, you know. And he says, your name, Geshe Michael? And I'm like, yeah. And he said, yeah. And he said, yeah, somebody, one of your students paid for it and doesn't want you to know who they are. And I'm here to, this is the limo, you know. And I said, well, I was going to go in that van, you know. And they said, no, you got to get in the limo. So it's a I get into the limo and 17 students follow me into the limo. You know, I've never had such an uncomfortable ride in my life. You know, I'm not kidding. I'm crushed into the corner, you know. And all these students are having a good time and watching the TV and drinking all the stuff and eating all the peanuts. And I've never been so uncomfortable. It's like this two-hour ride. You know, and that's what starts to happen. And some other people had to go in the van and they had the most comfortable ride, they told me. And so anyway, that's the kind of thing you can expect. All right, last, in the closing lines he says, turn these five signs of the days of darkness around us into a path to enlightenment. These words of advice are like the essence of nectar. They were passed down through Sanimba. He says the last thing because he wants people to know that even though these instructions were kept secret for so long, he didn't make them up. He says, ultimately they came from Lord Atisha, back from Saralinga and Maitreya, and this is not something Geshe Chikawa made up. I wrote it down because I thought it would be useful. Okay? The sign, yeah.
Can you repeat that again?
Which part?
The beginning of the author.
Oh, anyway, he's crediting Serlingba, which is Lord Atisha's compassion teacher from Indonesia.
Can you repeat
that? Oh, it says, these words of advice are the essence of nectar. They were passed down through Serlingba.
The first part.
Oh, the first part I'm going to cover. Turn these five signs of the days of darkness around us into a path to enlightenment. They're supposed to be that these are dark days, you know. People in the world, this is the best crowd we can scrounge up out of 5 billion people or something. You know what I mean? There's only 50, 60 people interested in learning how not to be selfish. You know what I mean? And for every one of you sitting here, there's 10 million or 50 million people who could care less about this stuff. You know, you say, guess what? I can teach you how to take care of other people before yourself. And they're like, why? You know what I mean? And you know what I mean? And they just don't, not at all attracted to it. And these are called dark days. Okay, Dharma-wise, you know, it's nice to have such a beautiful group, and we had an unbelievable time here. It is the most unbelievable place I've seen in India, and it's definitely one of the nicest places I've been in a long time. But what is it in the world? You know what I mean? I mean, there's billions of people in the world. For every one of you, there's 10, 20, 30 million people who could care less about this stuff. You know what I mean? That doesn't interest them at all. It doesn't sound interesting to them at all. That's a barometer of where our world is at right now. Okay. Then the positive end of that is that those of you who are studying Vajrayogini, there's this teaching, there's this tradition, and I truly believe in it, that there's a mandala of Chakrasamvara over the world, still facing this world. You know, like I imagine it over in New York City. I imagine the Twin Towers are like the axis of the mandala or something. Sometimes I think like that, or the World Trade Center. And I can actually, you know, pretend that I could see this mandala. And they say that, I don't know if you know this history of Chakrasamvara's mandala, but he swiped it from an evil deity. And that's, it used to be inhabited by this evil people. And the 64 deities of this mandala are actually, the bodies are left over from the old days. So that's why it's Ugdoma, Kinoma, Pagoma, Shagoma, you know, dog-faced lady, owl-faced lady. You know, there's these horrible names for them. It's because they decided to keep the old bodies, and they moved into this mandala. So there are these 64 enlightened beings took over this mandala, and they kept these ugly bodies. They still have these, but they're totally compassionate enlightened beings. Okay, and they say that the reason they kept it that way was in anticipation of our times, meaning the way this mandala works now is that the worse things get on this planet, the more corruption, morally, you know, the more selfishness, the more people have very cruel minds, and the worse things get, that this mandala gets more and more powerful. You see what I mean? I like that vision. You see what I mean? They say Chakrasamvara's power and the power of goodness of this mandala becomes more and more. The worse things get on the planet, then this thing becomes more glorious and more shining, and then more and more energy is coming down in the form of Dharma and things like that. You know, it's like that real Dharma practice should feed on negativity. You see what I mean? Like, and they say like a flower, like a lotus, feeds off of mud. When you go to Sarah, you'll see some real lotuses by the side of the road. We jumped out to try to get some, and then just as I'm heading across this the shore of the lake, I saw a bull, and he took one step and he sank down to his stomach. You know, and I'm like, whoa. You know, and then we paid some kids to swim out and pick the lotuses, you know. And, you know, but the thing is, it's got to be pure, filthy muck. It has to be, it has to have crap in it, it has to have mud in it. And then lotus can grow. You see what I mean? And Lojong, the whole point of Lojong is this Chakrasamvara theory that the worse things get around us, the more corruption, the more selfishness, the more war, you know, the more that people are less interested in compassion, then this teaching gets more powerful. And, you know, then you just come in on your white horse and save everything. See what I mean? There's so much to save. See what I mean? You come in like a hero, Bhattar. You know, and it's really true. You know, it doesn't take much to be a good person nowadays. See what I mean? Like, if you just practice pretty good, you know, and you're pretty sincere, and you teach people a little lojong, you know, it feels so wonderful to people because things are so bad. You see what I mean? Life is so bad. People are so selfish that you teach them just a little bit of thing about your happiness will increase every inch that you lower your selfishness. You see, every inch that you can try to imagine how the other person is thinking and what they would like to have at this very moment, every time you think about it, then huge progress is made in the world because the world is so bad right now. You see what I mean? And I'm just saying, you can check it out, okay? Every 30 seconds, you can try to think of what somebody else would like. Even if it's like, what would they like to eat right now? Or what would they like to drink right now? Or what would they like me to say right now? Every time you think that, your happiness level like doubles, okay? So just if you want to be a happy person, you know, and you see people just going around with smiles on their face all the time, just try to think about other people. Think about what they want. Watch them. There's a thing they teach young monks in the monastery. It's called watching other people. They teach you to spy on people. And they get so good at it that you sit down and there's a cup of tea in front of you. And you're like, how do you know I like this kind of tea? I've never been here before. And what they do is they teach the young monks to watch your eyes. So you got to be careful when you get there, right? Like if you're admiring somebody's mandala, then next morning you find it in your door. You know what I mean? Because they train the monks to watch people, to see what they like, see what they want, see where their eyes hesitate, you know, and then give it to them, make them happy. See what I mean? So you have to try to start doing that, okay? Be a Dharma spy, watch people's eyes, and make it your career to figure out what other people would like, and then give it to them. See what I mean? And it makes you happy. It's just like the neatest thing to do. It's the happiest thing you can do. Okay, one question. Yeah.
Why did they anticipate that the ugly bodies would be more effective?
They're omniscient. Okay. Not really. Tradition. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Did you have a question?
Five,
yeah.
Signs.
Oh, I wrote them in the reading. I took them out of another commentary and wrote them in the reading. Generally, its lifespans are less. People fight more. People have more mental afflictions. There's less compassion. And by the way, we're talking billions of years. I mean, I can't say that Genghis Khan killing, you know, a million people in 1200 was much less cruel than what goes on now. You know what I mean? I mean, cruelty is on the level that exists now. As far as kalpas or eons, we're just about the level that we're in the caveman days. I mean, that's what it means in the Dharma. I mean, these things change very slowly. Things stay around for a few thousand years. You can see a pattern. Okay. Last thing. I'm not being, how do you say? Pelegya in Tibetan means I'm not trying to flatter Namgyala and Sandrala and Sunila, but you know, we were a little, I was a little hesitant to come here because I heard it was just hippies on the beach. And I thought maybe we wouldn't be able to have a course here because nobody would be serious. And then Petra talked me into it, actually. She said, no, it's not like that. Just go, you know. And so we came. And physically, I mean, I can't, especially after having been in Bihar a lot. And I'm not putting down Bihar. The word Bihara means sacred place, temple, and I believe it is. But it's good to take a rest sometimes too. It's a Dharma thing to take a rest. So it's the most beautiful place I ever taught, and I really wanted to thank Namgyala and Sandra for bringing us here. Yeah. And the room they put me in is unbelievable, and the food is really good. And that's due to Mercedes worked on the food, so I'd like to thank her. Yeah. And Ian, and I'd like to thank Elizabeth Prather, who, you know, and Fran Diane, who did all the tickets, all the arrangements, all the hassles. It's incredible hassles. I took 15 people to India in 1995. I swear I'd never do it again. They've done like 50, 60, 70, 80 people, so I'd like to thank them. I'd like to thank my own direct assistants who, you know, they mostly get abused by people who think that they get to talk to me all the time, and they don't. They sign up for an appointment, they get it 6 months later or something. But really take care of my whole life in a very sweet way, in a very beautiful way. So I'd like to thank Christy and Aura. And Ian Law, who helps a lot, and Rob, who helps a lot, and Debbie Bry helps, Amber. Anyway, everybody does. In New York City, the last class we had there, there were 70 people there. And I went around the room and started to thank all the people who are working as volunteers on major projects, and it was 50 of them. And it's beautiful. It's really beautiful. We have a very sweet group, and everyone is doing the right thing. I mean, everybody is helping, and it's very, very sweet. So I'd like to thank all of you for that. Okay. Also, we'd like to give a present to Namgyala, Sandra, and Sunny, which we're printing out on special paper, some special sutras that we translated, and it's not ready yet, and we're going to get to it later. So later, okay? No, but thank you. It's the most beautiful place, the most amazing place. Thank you for having us. Okay, we'll do a dedication. Do a good job on the dedication, okay? Very important. All the karma we collected here, all the sweet stuff. By the way, especially Sunny, thank you for all the food. And he used to sneak in every morning on the with croissants and other impossible things. I'd like to thank Venerable Phil also for the beautiful chanting. And my dream, my hope is that he learns chanting well from some of the chanting masters. He's learned a lot already from Geshe's in Italy, but my dream is that he learns a lot more and then that he writes more chants in a Western tones, you know what I mean? I think the one is really beautiful that he does, so... Request that you do that one. Okay.
All right.
Here we go. Do a good dedication. Okay. Really get the karma out there. Then we don't prostrate on the last teaching, and it means we have unfinished business together in Goa, around 2003. All right. Okay.
Jang Zhu Zhen Zhou Dui Ho.
This is the end of Session 7. You have been listening to The 7-Point Practice for Developing a Good Heart with Geshe Michael Roach, recorded live in Goa, India. To contact us on other courses available or for further information, please check our website at www.world-view.org.